Good evening. While I wait for my Bible to load up, it's a little slow. I use not the traditional Bible. If you'd like all to turn to Luke 8, that's where we're going to be today. And in about verse 26 is where we're going to start. And while you turn there, let me just start out by giving my thanks that the elders allowed me up here as per usual. I thank you for the opportunity. It gives me a chance to hone my skills and as well a moment to proclaim a message from the Bible, which is a pretty awesome book. So, and I also want to thank the audience as well for being a willing participant. Otherwise, this wouldn't really work the same. Luke 8 is pretty far inside of a book that we're just going to dive right into, and I'm going to draw out some early chapters in just a moment, but specifically we're talking about the story of Jesus, and you might know him as Legion, and I just want to simply walk through the story and have fun just walking through what we normally might skip. So here, starting in verse 26, Luke 8:26. Then they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. And when he stepped out onto the land, a man from the city met him who was possessed with demons. And he had not put on clothing for a long time and was not living in a house, but among the tombs. The first question I want to pose to you today is, why do you care? Personally, I've never been homeless. I've never had to worry about lack of clothes. I sure haven't lived in a graveyard before. And I can't tell you the last time I've invited 6,000 demons into my head. Let me show you something. And don't get me wrong. I'm not going to try to make some mystical deep connection tying in the Bible on itself. I just want to show you a pattern. And it starts in Genesis 3. And here it says in Genesis 3, "Now the serpent was more cunning than any animal of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, 'Has God really said to you, shall not eat from any tree of the garden?'" Here in the very first pages of Scripture, we have a moment in which there is something tempting human. And of course, we go further in the chapter. Eve eats the fruit. Adam joins soon after, and then in verse Genesis 3:7, "Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked." What was stripped from them was the innocence that God had under them, or that they were under God in Eden. This action they did, we call sin. This was the only rule that God said not to do, and they did, and they immediately recognized something wrong. Now, again, there was this long dialogue past 7 where God, the snake, man, and woman have all this banter with one another, save for another day. But he ends it with saying, "So he drove the man out." It's funny. Mr. Charles's lesson this morning actually kind of poked at some similarities. Did they die? Well, they died physically eventually, but did they die because of their sin? Yes. And so I'm just pointing out that from the very first pages of Scripture all the way up until now, we see very similar patterns. These demons might come in different formats through the years. They might be something you're dealing with. They might be several sins in your life that you've let go out of touch for too long. And so hopefully I've touched on it just enough to convince you that you can not only relate to this man, you are this man. We're all living similar compromised lives to him. So as we go down this story, just keep that in mind, that you do want to pay attention because it affects you directly. So moving on, in Luke 8, verse 28, And seeing Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What business do you have with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." So this little phrase that's here, "What business do you have with me?" In English, it roughly translates to "what to you and what to me." It's a Greek idiom, meaning what's the purpose of what's happening right now between you and me? Notice a couple of things. That the demon is well aware who Jesus is. There is no question of power at play here. Jesus, Son of the Most High God. He's talking to none other than the highest form. And then he immediately goes into, "I beg you, do not torment me." Now, we're going to hold on to that for later. It's going to be more important. But just know, as of right now, Jesus has the authority. And so, I said I was going to take you backwards. Go to Luke 4. So, Luke 4 is interesting because it starts the major movement of this book. One of the bigger movements is from Luke 4 to Luke 9. And it's a whole coherent thing. And so Jesus starts out Luke 4 by being in the wilderness, and he's tempted by the Satan, or the adversary, and he kills it on every level. He just slams dunks this battle. All three tests, good. He's good. Upon which he finds himself in a synagogue reading from the book of Isaiah. And what he reads from Isaiah, he essentially points directly to himself. And then the response of the people was this. Luke 4, verse 32. They were amazed at his teaching because his message was with authority. Okay, so a little bit more things happen after this moment. The focus is authority. Second, go down a little further in verse 34. And he comes across his first demon that is outside of his own temptation. He's now in his ministry. This is the first example we have of him face to face with a demon in this nature. And here's what it says. "Leave us alone. What business do you have with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be quiet and come out of him." And when the demon threw him down in the midst of the people, it came out of him without doing any harm. And amazement came upon them all, and they began talking with one another, saying, "What is this message? For with authority and power he commands the unclean spirits, and they come out." Okay, if you clock out right now, take this away, that Jesus has the ultimate authority, and he can help you. If you're with me, this is going to help you understand a lot more subtleties about exactly what Jesus' authority is. And I think it'll blow your mind a little bit to see how he operates. So going back to Luke 8. If we look in verse 29, there's a peculiar verse, and we might immediately take that it's telling us something about the demon, but I would make a humble argument. Check this out. "For he had already commanded," this is verse 29 of Luke 8, "for he had already commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for it had seized him many times, and he was bound with chains and shackles, and kept under guard, and yet he would break the restraints and be driven by the demon into the desert." Question, is it showcasing to you how tough the demon is, or is it showcasing something else? Well, it's not wrong to see how tough the demon is. He's clearly a force to be reckoned with, something that us humans alone can't actually intervene in. Chains, shackles, under guard, we tried it all. We can't keep this dude down. Jesus can. And I would argue that's what this verse is itching at, is that where human intervention sometimes can't cope with problems, Christ can. And so you might suspect a huge bang is coming. You know, Jesus is going to pull out this level 99 miracle that just completely eradicates this boy, right? Or these, this army of demons. His approach is a little more subtle. Because in verse 30, what does Jesus ask? Well, Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," because many demons had entered him. Now, very quickly, let me go into something. Whenever I hear this lesson, it's usually immediately poked at that there's some sort of Greek interpretation happening here. Let me explain. So, in the Greek ideology of demons and people who could gain power over them, once you gain the name of a spiritual being, you more or less are able to conquer that being, or something like that. However, just from what we discussed up above, the demon already knew how much power Jesus had. He didn't have another card to play anyways except to start begging. That's all the demon's going to do the whole story, if you were curious that he would do anything else. And so I find that interpretation a little difficult. There's another way to look at it, and I would argue from the context, this is one of those moments, it's not to be pried too far. What if Jesus is just asking the man's name? You know, like, "Hi, I'm Casey. What is your name?" Jesus was talking to this human being. It specifies here in verse 30 that it says Jesus asked him, the man. And of course the man answered. But then in verse 31 it says, "And they were begging." I think Jesus gave a mercy call here and he was just trying to talk to the man. Now if you want deeper discussion on that, please feel free to ask me my feelings of a Jewish interpretation if anybody is a nerd. But it doesn't need to be here. So regardless of who Jesus asked, he got his answer. Legion. And I've told you already, but legion is a Greek military word, meaning it's a group of people, specifically 6,000 people, which is in this guy's head. I do believe that the reason this story has worded it in such a way is to showcase to you that this man is fully compromised. This man has more problems than you could ever imagine. And I'm not suggesting it's saying this in place of something. He was demon-possessed. But as readers of this story, what are we to take away? That's not fathomable. But I would argue these demons might come in different places. And that these demons come in different forms, whether that be lusts, these temptations, prideful attitudes, name it. Put your own, check the sin box, whatever is your struggles. And then we can start to really take away things from the story. In verse 31, these demons were begging him not to command them to go away into the abyss. I promise I'll speed up, but I need to tell you a few words just to help your understanding later. Now, these demons begged something of Jesus, and they said, "Don't let us go into the abyss." Now, the Greek word for abyss is an interesting one. It means bottomless or of no end. This word actually comes from the Greeks not being able to measure oceans. They knew that some ocean floors were on some shallow depths, but you see, they didn't have the technology to necessarily hit the very bottom. Therefore, they didn't have a word for it. But they did have a word for bottomless. And specifically, it's connected to the lake that these demons are about to jump off, and I'll get to that in a moment. Hold on to that word abyss. It's going to be pretty cool. Now, in verse 32, "Now there was a herd of many pigs feeding there on the mountain, and the demons begged him to permit to enter the pigs." That's curious, because These demons begged him not to go to the abyss, and yet they were looking around in this man, and they saw an opportunity. And they said, Jesus, how about, would you let us into these pigs? How about that? You want us out of the man. We want in the pigs. Funny enough, Jesus doesn't have any qualm with that at all. And in the same verse, in verse 32, he says, and he gave them permission. Notice the authority on Jesus is still there. That he's not willing to necessarily shut this down. He's willing to humor it. In verse 33, and the demons came out of the man and entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. So, interesting question for you that I fully haven't figured out, but I think I have a pretty good idea. I would be interested to hear what you might have to say. But did Jesus put them in the lake, or did they put themselves in the lake? My current understanding, the short answer is no. Jesus did not put them in the lake. He gave them permission to go to the pigs. However, if Jesus is life, if Jesus is everything good, what does that say about evil? That its natural conclusion is death, and they put themselves in the abyss because that's all evil can come to. Now check this out. Let me get a little more clear with you. I'm going to steal some language from Paul, from Romans chapter 1, and he says things like this, referring to human history and large sufferings and punishments and things of this nature. Therefore, God gave them up to vile impurity. That's verse 24. And for this reason, God gave them up to degrading passions. Really quickly, let me touch on this, that we all, at least in my experience, I'm used to hearing people talk about that we serve a God that drops a hammer on us immediately. I would argue that is a form of authority, but I don't believe it's God's authority. I believe God's capable of doing that in certain circumstances, but I don't think generally that's true, lest I steal candy from the store and be hit by lightning. Hadn't happened yet. But there's something more profound and tricky that happens that the devil can ploy too. And our distant brother James, for example, he says in chapter 1, verse 14 and 15, but each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it has run its course, brings forth death. Sin is a little more subtle than we would like to believe because it's very uncomfortable. And just like this man who's built up 6,000 demons, none of us are beyond the capability of building up this much problem and this much compromise. I do believe this is what the story is trying to draw out. There is some profound teachings that we can take away from this first half of the story, is that Jesus does have the authority, but he's not above letting you kill yourself. If I choose to live a life that is compromised to Jesus, he is going to let me do it. On the flip side of that, if I admit that I'm a compromised individual and I see the room that I need to grow and I need to get right, Jesus is waiting right there. And I'm going to pose a hypothetical question because the story doesn't actually tell us, but I would like you to consider the question of what happened to the man if Jesus never actually showed up. Could it possibly be the man was the one that gotten driven off the cliff? Like I said, it's not in the story, but I do believe this particular story is not above ending your own life at your own hand. In some sense, this is a very grim and terrifying story. However, it doesn't end there. So here is the next big chunk of this story. Starting in verse 34. Now when the herdsmen saw what had happened, they ran away and reported everything in the city and in the country. And the people came out to see what had happened. And they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone out, sitting down at the feet of Jesus, clothed in his right mind, and they became frightened. So before we focus on the herdsmen, check this out. From the very first verses that we started from, this man was fixed. He was no longer stripped of his clothing nor house. And just from the text, he's sitting at the feet of Jesus. Would you say that he found his home? That's where I'd like my home to be. And, of course, in his right mind. So his demons had been removed and thrown off the cliff. It's one thing to tell you that Jesus is capable of doing this, but it's another thing for you actually to realize if Jesus has done it at all. Because the story flips in a new character called the herdsman. And you can respond poorly to Jesus as well. As you see, they became frightened. In verse 36, those who had seen everything reported to them how the man who had been demon-possessed had been made well. So it goes out of its way to tell you twice that the people saw what Jesus did. This man had a reputation. The demon-possessed man had the reputation. Chained to a tomb, guarded, flung himself out in the desert all the time. These people knew this guy. And they saw a stranger come up on a boat and completely fix this guy. I would like to think if I saw that, I would come and just bow down at the master's feet. However, there seems to be a mindset and heart that's capable of not doing that. Check this out in verse 37. And all the people of the territory of the Gerasenes and the surrounding region asked him to leave because they were overwhelmed by great fear. And he got into a boat and returned. So check this out for a minute. It's almost as if the story is showcasing to you that if I'm the herdsman and Jesus is right here, and on the other side of Jesus is the cliff full of pigs that just fell, I just would have said, hey, Jesus, move out of the way. My pigs! Leave! Why? They didn't like anything that Jesus represented. And they're willing, in a sense, just like the demons, to go right over the cliff with their agendas and their priorities and their cares that aren't Christ. And before we just want to tear down the herdsmen, I would argue that I think that all of us has probably been at that mode, that I don't think it's a secret that sin is kind of fun in some way or another. Otherwise, why do it? It doesn't make any sense. We prioritize ourself, whether that be I need to do X, I need to drink, I need to look at these women, I need to not show up to service, I need to not do this. Are we not brushing Jesus out of the way every time we do that? So the herdsman as a character is also a wonderful thing to examine and to study. We can fall into those same things. Now, once again, the story does not end, and this is the last piece of the story. In verse 38, but the man from whom the demons had gone out was begging him that he might accompany him, but Jesus sent him away saying, Return to your home and describe what great things God has done for you. So he went away proclaiming throughout the city what great things Jesus had done for him. Okay, so it shifted back to the man again. Now here's a couple of notes for you. I found this very interesting. Notice how the conversation started, that whenever Jesus was talking to the demons, they started out by begging him. Well, the man here also starts out begging him. And the contrast is interesting because while Jesus humored the proposition of the demons, he gave them permission to go into the pigs, this man, he said, no, I'm actually going to deny that request. And here's why. I want you to go proclaim something far greater than anything you could have ever imagined. I want you to tell everybody what happened today. I want you to tell people how I helped you and to proclaim these things. I asked a question a little earlier. How do we know if Jesus has helped us? Is he bleeding out in your daily lives? Is he in your breath? Is he on your conversations? Are you helping others who are sick? Because I do tell you this, I've been going to this church for a long time and I've learned great things from a lot of you. But I will tell you that I have learned terrible things from some of you. And one of it is which you go by people that have issues and you bypass them. I've seen it since I was a child. It's not you in particular, I suppose it's humans not wanting to deal with it. I've been guilty of the exact same thing. But if we've learned anything from Jesus' authority, it's not that he's not understandable. It's that if you actually feel like Jesus has helped you, or if you know for a fact that you are a Christian that Jesus has solved problems to, why aren't you going up to people and saying, what's your name? It's hard, and I get it. But it's also necessary to copy Jesus' exemplar attitude with this man. If you are not a Christian and you find the need to investigate to be one, we can help you right now. We have water in the back to do so. We have people here who you can study with. As per most of you are Christians, maybe you realize that demons have overtaken you a little more than you might have realized. We can help you with that too right now. We can talk about it. We can pray. Hey, we can hug it out. Not everything is solved with knowledge. But please, if you find yourself in these grim circumstances, just know that Jesus is there to help. We can accomplish all these things as we stand and sing.